Welcome to
BirdWorld.com. A podcast for those involved in designing, developing, and running websites. This is what everybody waits for. Hello and welcome to the 95th episode of BoAgWorld.com, the podcast for those involved in designing, developing and running websites on a daily basis. My name's Paul Boag and Marcus is with me today. Hooray!
Yay! Yeah, no one would ever know that was your eighth attempt at starting this podcast, would they, Paul?
No. I'm really on form today. It's going to be great. It's going to be a great show. Lots of pizzazz today.
And we neither of us sound particularly pizzazzy.
No.
I'm from England. It's getting cold, so we're getting colds.
Yeah, I'm overcompensating. This is going to be the Broadway edition of I'm going to sing, and I'm wearing a spangly leotard right now. Just thought everybody would like to know that. So, yes, I'm excited, getting really excited about the 100th episode now. Five weeks to go. Actually, a lot less than 5 weeks to go, because we're actually recording it before it actually airs, which is going to be very, very confusing. But anyway. So, yes, we've got the 100th episode coming up on the 20th of October. Please come
on.
Can
I have a little... I want to say something there. Guys, I want to have the best jokes I've ever told for this show, and they all seem to have dried up. So please send me some more jokes. Please.
Also,
they can be reasonably rude. No, they can't be, can they? Because this is going to...
You can have some off-air jokes and some on-air jokes.
Yes, excellent. So please send them in.
Yes. And we're going to do, I reckon, loads of questions and comments and anything you want to send in. If you send an email to paul@boagworld.com entitled with the subject line 100th Boag World, then we'll collect them all together and we'll read them all out on the show and we'll try and make it as mainly answering questions, either from people that have sent them in that can't attend or for people that are actually there. So loads of questions. And we might even have some prizes for the best questions. I've been on a swag hunt. It's been great. Hey. So I'm getting some swag, hopefully from the BBC. I'm getting some, hopefully from Yahoo. I've got 5 annual subscriptions to .NET Magazine to give away, which is cool. I've got a free CSS beginners course to give away from Drew and Rachel Andrews. Drew and Rachel, who everybody should know because they've been on the show, I think. Yes,
we have.
Yes, that's fine. Really excited about all of that. It's going to be really good. And I'm working on more swag too. So yeah.
Everyone look forward to the 4-hour show.
No, it's going to be fine. Because
it's going to be the biggest edit job I've ever done, isn't it?
Yeah, Definitely. So if you're going to come to that, you can sign up at upcoming.yahoo.com/event/224744. That's 224744. Wow, I'm getting good at saying that now. So there you go. It's all very exciting. So what are we going to do on today's show? Marcus, what are you talking about?
I'm talking about project timescales and making them realistic.
After you've just received today a very unrealistic one.
Yes.
But we won't.
Which I'll mention. I will mention. He said it was okay. So I will.
Okay, that's cool. Other than that, the show's pretty much a kind of markety, salesy type show, has to be said, because I'm going to be talking about kind of using your online profile as a method of selling your web design services. So particularly useful if you're maybe a freelancer or somebody like that. But we've also got a guy called Ben Hunt onto the show, and he's going to be talking about marketing your web business. So some really kind of marketing salesy stuff today, which should be quite interesting. But obviously, before we're allowed to do any of that, we have to do the obligatory news section.
BirdWorld.com.
So how long do you think we've been doing this podcast now, Marcus? Have you got any idea?
11, 12 years, not that. Must have been. Might have been late 80s, actually.
Like late 80s. No, that was when your pop career faded.
career. No, it wasn't. The early 90s when my pop career faded.
Oh, right, okay.
Late 80s was my heyday, Paul.
Ooh. So it's got to be a couple of years, do you reckon? It's got to be 2 years, isn't it? So I reckon
about 104 shows is in theory 2 years, and we're on 95 now, but we've missed a few weeks out. So yeah, it's good.
So I reckon about 2 years. So we've been doing this podcast about 2 years, and in that entire time, I think, very humbly, that it's fair to say that we've reigned supreme. And that, you know, okay, there have been other web design podcasts out there, but let's be frank, they've all been shit. I think that's fair to say. Would you agree with that, Marcus?
100%, yes. Yeah. I've never listened to another one, but yes, they are all rubbish.
Now, obviously, out of politeness, we pretended that they were good. But, you know, when it came down to it, I think everybody knows that Boag World is really the only web design podcast worth listening to.
Absolutely.
100%. Except, obviously, the .NET one, which is much better because you're not on it. But but other than that. But I have to say, like all great empires, sooner or later, it crumbles as a new rising star kind of takes over. And I fear that that might be true with Boag World. Because there's a new kid on the block. Yeah, there's a really good new kid on the block called the Rissington Podcast. And it's hosted by John Oxton and John Hicks, who are both bastards because they're horribly talented. And they're now getting into the podcasting arena. So they're two really good web design freelancers. And they've put together this podcast. Now, they're only on episode one because they did a pilot and now they're on their first proper episode. And it's too damn professional. It's really well put together. And it's got this really kind of nice feel to the show and it's very, very funny at times. It's basically a rambling kind of question-based show which provides some great advice on web design. And it's kind of done in this really kind of entertaining and friendly manner. And what's really good is it's very British as well, because these guys work on an old RAF base. So it's kind of got this Morse code.
Watto.
Yes, Ninja. Exactly. And it's just absolutely superb. So that, unfortunately, is my first news story for the day, is to say go and check out the Rissington podcast. It is absolutely superb and you will really love it. But obviously, just because they're a question-based show, just ask a little bit of a favour. You know, just send in every week a question going, you know, don't you feel that the Boag World podcast is so much better and actually it's pointless for you to carry on? So if you
I feel
just,
sorry for myself.
Why do you feel sorry for them?
Because, you know, we've been over the same continent 14 times, so, you know, they're going to have to repeat us again.
Yeah. Well, no, because they talk about a real bizarre mix of things. They don't even pretend to be just about web design. They do talk about because they just do answer whatever questions they get in. They get some really bizarre questions as well, like what's your favorite cheese, because John Hicks has got a bit of a weird obsession with cheese. And they get asked about if you could travel. I think one of them was if you could travel either backwards or forwards in time, which would you do? Things like that. So backwards. It's not all about web design. Yeah, that's what they both said. But I'd go forward, see. But anyway, now just ripping off their content.
What you find, Paul?
Yeah,
at least you know what's there when you go backwards.
Yeah, but I'd go so far forward that I'd be dead by the time that all happened anyway. See?
Anyway, yes, I think this is excellent. This is what we should have done this 50 episodes ago. Ask us anything you like.
No, but that's what they're doing now, so we can't do that.
They've just done it.
The market.
Too late. Said it. It came out of my mouth. Oops.
We could do that for the 100th episode, couldn't we? Our 100th episode could just be a rip-off of their podcast, which is far better.
I don't know why people never ask me questions about playing the guitar or anything like that. But it's something I actually know about.
Because they're not interested. It's a web design podcast, for crying out loud. Set up your own music one if you want to do that.
No. Anyway. Rambling now.
Yes. So talking about other podcasts, in last week's .NET Magazine podcast, you know, the one without Marcus in, that's so much better, we got talking about how to kind of measure the improvements that you're making in your website, especially when it comes to kind of user experience. You know, how do you prove to the client that the changes that you make have actually improved the user experience? Well, we had a guy from Adaptive Palette on who mentioned something called the Net Promoter Score. Sorry?
Adaptive Path.
What did I say?
Palette.
Ah, Who's Adaptive Palette?
Never heard of them.
No, that sort of reminds me of somebody. Who was that company we used to work with in Manchester?
Graphic Palette.
I'm getting them confused. I knew that there was a palette somewhere. Anyway, yes.
Did you not get enough sleep last night, Paul?
I'm fine. I'm like hyped. Yes, I'm going to be well and happy. So anyway.
Carry on.
Yes. So there was, Adaptive Path. A guy from Adaptive Path, Peter from Adaptive Path, was on talking about the Net Promoter Score, right? Which I'd never heard of, but he reckoned the Net Promoter Score is a good way of measuring kind of user experience and improvements in user experience. And I was like, yes, you know, I agreed and sounded like I was being intelligent and knew what he was talking about. But actually, I didn't. Now, fortunately, I wasn't alone in my ignorance because Andy Budd, who was also on the show, hadn't come across the term either. However, of course, Andy is a lot more professional than me. And after the show, he went away and did some research into the Net Promoter Score. And he's posted some findings on his website of what he discovered. So let me just read you a little bit about this because I think this is quite interesting. To calculate your Net Promoter Score, you ask your customers, how likely are you to recommend us to a friend? Okay? You get to grade the answer on a scale of 0 to 10. 0 would be extremely unlikely, and 10 is very likely. Those that answer 9 or 10 are considered promoters and are the most likely people to evangelize your service. Those who answer 0 to 6 are considered detractors and are the type of people who would spread negative views about your service. So to work out your Net Promoter Score, you simply subtract the percentage of detractors from the percentage of promoters. So a good score would range between 50 and 80%, while an average score would be between 5 and 10%, and a poor score would be a negative value. And Andy goes on to explain about how this kind of very basic question can be used to assess the value of your service. And so I can really see why Peter brought this up. And it's kind of an excellent way of assessing the improvement in your user experience. You test before the site is redesigned and you test again after it's done. So I just thought that was a really cool way. And I think we ought to try that on the next project we do. What do you think?
Yeah, why not?
Oh, wow. The overwhelming enthusiasm there.
It's all right, yeah, okay. I'm just kind of taking it in at the moment.
Well, it's like, it's just, the whole, it's a good question. I think this, the idea that asking people how likely are you to recommend us to a friend is a really good question, because a recommendation is a lot more of an active thing than just saying, did you like our service? I think it's good. And I think we need something measurable, some tangible way of justifying kind of user experience work, because it's quite a hard thing to measure.
Yeah, if we're going to do, we do quite a lot of usability testing, that kind of thing. If you threw that in, probably later on in a project, once people have got a not early testing, then yes, you've got a you've got a real a figure that you can attach to it. Which normally it's just sort of it's words, isn't it? And you know, this 3 out of 5 testers thought this was a good idea.
It's not
valuable. Yeah, okay. All right, okay. We'll do it.
Right, I'm glad I've got your approval. I can now move on to the next story. This is a bit of a random news story, but I really wanted to mention it anyway. I'm kind of really excited about the state of typography on the web at the moment, because there seems to be a kind of building momentum behind doing decent typography on websites. And I'm constantly amazed at just what is possible with a bit of determination, because let's face it, web-based typography is not the easiest thing in the world to do. Typography can be an incredibly powerful tool in our kind of design toolbox, so to speak. But, you know, sometimes it can be a challenging area to work in, and we perhaps need a bit of convincing or a bit of inspiration. So this week I came across 15 superb examples of web typography, which is a post somebody has put on their website. And it's got some really inspiring stuff in here. If you're feeling a little bit jaded about type on the web and it's always a bit of a struggle to do anything creative, go and check out these examples because they really are incredibly inspiring. Some really great typographic stuff there. And as always, you can get to those by just popping along to our show notes at boagworld.com/podcast, select episode 95. Okay, so last story up. And talking of being inspired, there was a post by Bill Thompson on the BBC technology site. Have you come across this guy before? The big beardy guy that always posts.
Yes. Yeah. I haven't seen this.
So, excuse me. Sorry about the cough. Me too. So, a lot of the time I don't like, you know, I'm not over inspired by what he necessarily writes, and it's kind of a bit mainstream and obvious for me. But I have to say that he's written something at the moment. It's not directly related to web design, but it certainly has gone a long way to kind of re-exciting me about the web, really, and what I do for a living. The article focuses very much on the social side of the web, and how it's transforming the way that we kind of interact, you know, and how we perceive the world and that kind of stuff. And it's really refreshing because while kind of other mainstream journalists seem to be hammering the social net as being a haven for child predators and a place where terrorists get trained how to make bombs, this Bill, this guy from BBC Technology, it talks about how it's uniting culture and making the news that we see on TV real again, about how normally we become very desensitized about what we're seeing on the news, but how the web has got the potential to kind of make it all a bit more real. Let me just read a bit from what he said. It'll be a lot clearer if I do that. What will happen when these people, referring to friends that we've made online through things like Facebook and Twitter and all the other things, what happens when these people start dying in famines or wars, or when the climate changes caused by global warming leads to floods and droughts and natural disasters? What happens when photos on Facebook and Flickr show devastated crops and starving families, and that these people are not just faces on television, but old friends, people whose likes and dislikes and reading habits and favourite films we know and share? The world is different when it's people you know, and I do not think we will be able to resist the force of change when our friends are dying on screen in front of us, and we know that we could do something but have decided not to. I found it really powerful, really powerful. The article really grasped, in my opinion, the power of the social web, a power that personally is something that I've kind of encountered a lot before. Running and developing online communities is a really kind of strange thing, and many perceive social networks as a kind of numbers game, a way of attracting traffic to their site. However, kind of in all the community work that I've ever done, you need to remember that at the heart of it, there are real people and real relationships. Let me give you an example of what I mean. I'll never forget a woman that I met called Crystal, who I met online and became friends with back in 1997 when I ran a virtual community. Crystal was just a housewife with a couple of kids, but unfortunately she was dying of cancer and as a result was housebound. For her, the virtual community that I was a part of was a lifeline to the real world and to kind of being in contact with other people. And for such a long time, she was kind of the heart and soul of our community until one day she died. And the kind of grief that I felt when she died was just as real as, even though I'd never met her face to face. I couldn't go to a funeral because she lived on the other side of the world. I never spoke to any of her family, but she felt like a real friend, and it was really bizarre when she died. And I know that this is a really heavy news story, and I didn't really mean it to be, but the kind of point that I wanted to make out of this, and what really got to me in Bill's article, was the fact that I think many online communities fail because people don't perceive them, you know, the people that run them don't perceive them as being a community of real people. They fail because they don't grasp that the communities, whether they're online or offline, are about people rather than the underlying features and technologies. And too many online communities that have been developed at the moment are just focusing so much on cramming more and more features in rather than building the relationships and the interaction that needs to drive the community. And I just think it'll be interesting to see what happens to online communities as they mature over the coming years. I don't know whether that's any help to anybody from a web design point of view, but it was a moving story, and so I wanted to mention it. There's nowhere to go now, is there really?
I've just
dug a really depressing big hole. I know. Let's move on to Marcus's section of the show. Okay, so Marcus, please lift the tone and take us excitingly into your section.
Yes, Marcus, follow that. Global sociology, death, famine, war, project timescales.
I'm sorry. That was a really ill-considered news story.
Okay, right, I shall certainly lighten the mood. I've often rambled on about the importance of contracts on this podcast, and within those contracts, the need for detailed specification, detailed task lists, and associated timescales and milestones. And I still think all of those things are really important. But the one in there that, out of all those things, that I want to discuss now is the timescales bit. How long, when things start and how long they take, and then obviously when they're finished. Milestones, of course, along the way are, you know, very, very important. But what I want to talk about today is the timescales themselves. I think that people, me included, often go into a land of fantasy when it comes to A, when they can start a project, and B, how long each one of those tasks will take. Clients are very guilty of this too. This is the typical scenario. This is what often happens. The client, not knowing how long the project will take, picks a date out of the air for project completion because they don't want it left open. Let's call this date Date X. Unless it's patently impossible to achieve, agencies will agree to this deadline because they don't want to adversely affect their bid. They don't want to be the ones to say, oh, no, we can't do that, and then they get chucked in the bin. So they agree to it. This client is then selected. This agency is then selected by the client to do the work, and then there's a certain amount of maybe back and forth over the delivery date because it takes longer to sort out a contract and maybe the spec or the scope has changed a bit. But the agency can't really move the date to somewhere comfortable for them because they've already agreed to date X. So the best they get is maybe date X plus 1 month, for example. The project then inevitably slips and both parties start blaming each other for it. The agency feels that the client is overly pushy, and worse, the client thinks that the agency is unprofessional, inattentive, whatever. They're not. They've agreed to something they couldn't deliver on. So you've got to be honest from the start and seriously do it. I was, as mentioned earlier, I was having a conversation this morning with a potential client. Hello, Graham. He said, I can mention his name. Who's looking for a new site. He has a particularly unrealistic deadline, which he was aware of the end of October. Now, I said, well, there's no way we can do that. And he said, well, yeah, I'm sure there's a bit of leeway that we can, you know, we realise that this is fairly unrealistic. And I basically said, well, Headscape, at the moment, we're manic. We're looking at starting new projects mid-November to the end of November. So the best we can do is the end of January. And this completely blew our chances of this project, but Graham appreciated the honesty, and he seemed to sort of tell me that this was a professional attitude. It was a professional thing to tell him that we couldn't do it and when we felt we could do it, rather than just kind of saying, well, yeah, we might be able to, and then dithering around on it. And I felt that he would possibly want to work with us again in the future. And if I had underestimated, favourite time for this time of year is to say, yeah, we can do it by Christmas, then I would have become very, very unpopular internally. And also, when we failed to deliver, because we wouldn't be able to do it by Christmas. It's very easy to say, because that's months away. But if you think about it, it doesn't work. Also, and this is a classic, and I'm talking to myself half the time here, don't forget you have other clients. It's so easy to think, oh, I don't know, standard CMS site redesign is 10 weeks. And then you go and quote a date for completion in 10 weeks' time on the proposal. But you mustn't forget the following. It usually takes at least 2 weeks to sign a contract, sometimes quite a lot longer. Do you have the resources internally to start straight away? What other projects are imminent? There could be the biggest project you've ever had, this 6 months to a year's project just about to sign, and it's going. That's going to affect everything, but it's not actually on the book, so to speak, as yet. And the other big one is staff holidays, especially in the summer. So you just need to bear these things in mind and take everything into account, I guess. Final point I'm going to make on this is basically educate your potential clients whenever you can. I think the problems I'm referring to relate to the fact that even now we're working in a relatively young industry. This means that many clients simply don't have an understanding of how long projects and the tasks within those projects take. This used to be a big problem with pricing. I used to go on about it, and it still is in some cases, but much less so. Client expectations of costs seem to be a lot more in line with each other than they were, say, 3 years ago. But I don't think that's the case with timescales. So if we can explain what we do and how long it takes right from the start with a potential client, with all potential clients, then hopefully client expectations of project length will also balance out. And that's my bit for this week.
Very true.
All forgotten. You've forgotten about death, famine and war, haven't you? Everyone else.
Yeah, now we're just depressed that we don't have long enough to do all the work that we've got to do. Which is just equally as bad, really, isn't it? Oh, well, never mind. Perhaps Paul's segment can cheer us up.
Birdworld.com.
Okay, so from time to time, I get a question that kind of reappears in my inbox, which is about kind of building a reputation in the field of web design. How do you become well known so that you can attract more work? And it's a fair question. And
the web design podcast.
Record a web design podcast, yes. Yeah. Seems to be the in thing to do these days. Damn them. Damn their talent. Damn them. I'm going on their show later. I'm trying to work out a way that I can kind of completely ruin it and, you know, destroy their chances. Grr. Yeah, so anyway. Yeah, they're even higher than us in iTunes already. They've only released one episode. Anyway, what am I talking about? Yes, so I put together a little article that is on the BOAG World site called The Geek's Alternative to Golf. And it's a bit of a dubious link, but basically the idea is that a lot of people play golf as a kind of networking thing, as a sales tool, basically. And I was saying
that's
personally,
a myth, you know. I really
you
do.
Oh, you reckon it's a myth?
I play golf. I think I've ever done any business, fingers in the air, on the golf course. I just to laugh.
Well, it was just a useful way of getting into the article, all right? Don't stop picking it apart. So basically, I was saying, what's the, you know, the myth is then that people play golf because they get to wander around with prospective clients and you can kind of softly sell at them. So what's the kind of geek's equivalent of doing that kind of stuff? Right, so first of all, I started off in this article talking about kind of blatant networking. And then the most obvious method of doing this is to use a service like LinkedIn, which I'm sure you've already heard of. Now, LinkedIn is aimed squarely at the business community, and its objective is to connect you to new business contacts through mutual acquaintances. At its heart, it's all about sales. It gives suppliers a chance to connect with potential customers through referrals, while buyers feel more confident in the suppliers because it comes as a recommendation from an existing contact rather than just, you know, out of the yellow pages or whatever. It all sounds great in principle. However, I'm yet to win any work through it, so I'm not entirely convinced that it actually works as a strategy. And it just seems like everybody adds everybody else just for the sake of it. And as somebody who isn't really a kind of hardcore salesperson, I feel it's kind of a bit heavy-handed and slightly aggressive and a bit kind of too obvious and not, you know, very appropriate maybe if you're a freelancer or, you know, or running a small agency or whatever. There's got to be better ways than using something like LinkedIn. I guess an alternative is to use one of the many social networking sites out there. The first that springs to mind is MySpace, but no self-respecting professional would be caught dead there, so we need to look a little further. The answer might lie in something like Facebook that appears to have exploded in popularity recently. I'm kind of continually amazed at just how many of my clients have Facebook pages and just how many new contacts I'm making through my Facebook account. How many of those will actually translate into real work, I'm not so sure. But it is a great way of keeping in touch with people that you meet through various mediums and stuff like that. The reason Facebook works so well is it's not as formal as a company website. It's your personal page and people respond better to individuals than they do to organisations. It's far easier to ask a quick question of a person on Facebook than complete a contact us form on the website and risk being hassled by a salesperson like Marcus. Sorry, Marcus. Of course, you have to give people a reason to add you as a friend to Facebook in the first place. They have to see a value in the relationship and what it is that you can offer. So what can you get out of an association with, you know, what can they want to know what they can get out of an association with you. And this brings us nicely on to the aren't I clever approach to social networking. Okay, so making contacts through sites like Facebook is not enough in itself. Although it gets you in front of people on a semi-regular basis, it does not associate you with kind of any kind of quality work or anything like that. Some degree of self-promotion is also going to be necessary. So telling the world how great you are is always a difficult thing to do. The problem is that if it comes out the wrong way, you end up sounding arrogant, and nobody wants to work with somebody like that. So the best approach is not to kind of promote yourself as such, but to let your knowledge and expertise talk for itself. The most common way of achieving this is through a blog. By writing about your experiences as a web designer, you naturally start to communicate the depth of your knowledge and expertise in the field. Blog posts can demonstrate your experience and so kind of reassure potential clients that you know what you're talking about. If you take the time to write your posts in plain English and avoid web design jargon, and you write it with your potential clients in mind, you're also doing some education there that they like. They think they're getting some real value out of it, and that makes them much more likely to want to work with you. I mean, Graham this morning is a classic case of that, who kind of, he came to us because he kind of felt he already knew us, we were a safe pair of hands because he'd already heard of us, etc. Of course, not all of us are great writers, but there are alternative ways of promoting your expertise. If you're a designer, your blog may consist mainly of examples of design work that you produce and a kind of short explanation of your approach and how you went about it. If you're a coder, you might focus on releasing code snippets that others can reuse. The most important thing is to express your knowledge and your passion for the subject. Of course, for me, it was a podcast. I found myself frustrated by only blogging, as it was much harder to express how enthusiastic I am about web design most of the time. And I think enthusiasm is an important sales tool in a way. By podcasting, I found that more of my passion came across and more of my enthusiasm came across. And of course, another advantage of podcasting over the written word is that you kind of get to know people better. So people, for example, that come to Headscape because of this podcast feel that they've already made a kind of connection with us and kind of know the type of people we are. And that is really important when people are selecting suppliers. One of the main reasons they select a particular supplier is because they know and like that person. Yep, now, of course, excuse me. Of course, the big fear with all of this is that if you're putting all this stuff on your blog or in your podcast or everything else, you're kind of giving away your competitive advantage and your intellectual property, so to speak. The reasoning goes that if you tell the world how you code a particular thing, for example, then your competition can use that knowledge. Now, to a certain extent, this is a legitimate concern. Indeed, I know that many competitors listen and learn from this podcast. However, ultimately, I believe the benefits kind of outweigh the drawbacks, really. Prospective clients, are so much more favorable towards us because of this podcast that really, if a few competitors kind of hear what we've got to say, then do I really care? Another important point is to consider that... when you're doing a blog or as you're talking about your expertise, you're raising your online profile, so you're more likely to be found. If you post content online, it will help you in search engine rankings, and if the content is good, people will link to you. On the other hand, if you fail to post for fear of losing competitive edge, then people are not going to discover you in the first place, so what's the point, kind of thing. But one other thing I would say, things like blogs and podcasts, social networks are all good and all good stuff. But sooner or later, you have to kind of confront the real world as well. And I think it's important that you don't forget to kind of go out in the real world. I think geeks are particularly liable to this one, that we probably don't like social interaction very much. But I think this is really, really important. That we can't just hide behind technologies when it comes to kind of selling ourselves and increasing our online profile. A big part of increasing your online profile is also increasing your offline profile. There are kind of no shortage of opportunities for you to meet other people, from conferences through to meetups. Start with engaging with the web design community. Sure, some of them are your competition, but many will work as in-house web designers or agencies in search of outside expertise. Conferences are a good way of meeting people, but meetups are even better, in my opinion. the kind of their informal gatherings of web designers, which is superb for networking, and there are lots of opportunities to socialize and chat. From things like Barcamp to Refresh, there are literally thousands of these get-togethers happening all over the world, and upcoming.org is a great place to check them out. Just search on web design. One of the problems you might encounter is having to travel. Many events tend to focus on larger cities. And so if you live in a rural area, as I do, that can turn into a bit of a pain in the ass. You know, I live in the middle of nowhere and it's a huge effort to go up to London, but it is worth the effort. So maybe attend meetups, you know, even if it's infrequently, just try and do it a little bit and keep in touch with, you know, with people that you meet at those meetups. So there's a good question. How do you keep in touch with people that you meet at meetups and conferences, especially if you can't go to every single one that happens? Well, Twitter, I believe, is the answer to this. I know a lot of people are rude about Twitter, but I think it's great for that, doing that join between people you meet at meetups and people that you know, and you then want to keep in contact with them on a regular basis. Think about the problem for a moment. You've met somebody for a couple of hours at a meetup. You get on with them well and you want to keep in touch. Now, you could swap phone numbers, but why would you call them? What reason have you got to call them? You certainly don't know them well enough to just call up for a chat. You could exchange email addresses, but what reason would you have for writing them? People get enough junk mail as it is without you pestering them with pointless emails with, you know, that have no real kind of business value. What you need is a kind of lightweight and informal way of keeping in touch with people, and Twitter, I think, is the answer. By adding a new contact to your Twitter list, you kind of track each other's thoughts and activities. My contacts on you know, Twitter post about their work, what they're doing, their home life, all kinds of random pieces of information. And by following this information, I have something to talk to them about next time I go to a meetup. You know, I know that one of my contacts failed his motorcycle test or that another one enjoyed his holiday in Spain. So it gives me something to discuss next time I see them. So I think in that sense, Twitter has got a real value. In short, Twitter keeps the relationship fresh even when there's long gaps without physical contact. Of course, this technique only works when both parties are on Twitter. However, more and more people are joining up to services like this, and it's certainly a good way of, you know, a good number of web designers are already using it. So just to finish off this section on it, I thought I'd share a couple of quick kind of tips for social networking that I've discovered that kind of make the whole process work better. Firstly, resist the temptation to actively sell at people. You know, when it's so easy to block someone or remove them from your friends list, the last thing you want to do is, you know, basically piss them off. If it's a prospective client that you're trying to talk to, you know, your talent through your blog and through your other writing should be enough without you kind of hassling them constantly through Twitter or Facebook. Secondly, in these social networks, use an actual picture of yourself. When registering for Facebook, Twitter, or any other social website, there's a temptation to use some clever icon or cartoon as your profile picture. Resist the urge. If you've met somebody for the first time at a meetup, they may well not remember your name, but they will remember your face if there's a picture of you. Finally, never dismiss anybody. If you become focused on sales and networking, you may find yourself judging people for their potential value. It is a mistake to shun somebody because you think, well, they're just a student or just a junior designer. I've learned from personal experience that anybody has the potential to bring in business. A junior designer can recommend you to his or her boss. A student will one day graduate and work for a company. Everyone has a value to your business and you shouldn't ignore anyone. And anyway, that's downright rude. So there you go. There's my tips for increasing your online profile. Hope that was useful. And what we got next? What's up next? Oh, yes. Next, we've got some more marketing advice. Now, maybe a bit more traditional marketing advice, not so much aimed at social networking. But we've got a guy in called Ben Hunt that's going to share a few bits and pieces with you. Birdworld.com.
Right, I'm going to be talking about marketing a web business. And the things that I'll cover will apply particularly to small web businesses, little shops, web designers. But the principles that we'll be going over will apply to the whole of web design, and in fact the design of any site at all. What I'm going to be talking about, I guess, comes under headology, psychology. It'll be stuff like self-perception, posture, attitude and brand, which are all really essential things. So, starting with brand, what is brand? Well, brand is how people perceive you, what you offer, what you can do for them, and what differentiates you from alternatives. Differentiation is absolutely vital, and you mustn't ever underestimate it. There's a couple of books that have been really influential in hammering this point home to me. The first one that I'd like to mention is called Purple Cow. It's written by Seth Godin, a kind of godfather of marketing. And the core premise of Purple Cow is whatever you do, you've got to stand out. You've got to be memorable. In the 21st century, just fitting in with people's general expectations, fitting in with a crowd, simply doesn't cut it anymore. The second book that I've really loved is called Zag, and it's written by a guy called Marty Neumeier. And it comes at the same kind of thing from a different angle. It says, when your competitors zig, you zag. You go in the other direction. Whatever's going on around you, you know, do whatever it takes to stand out, to be noticeable, and to go against the flow. Zag is also full of brilliant examples that explain why and also how you can go about it. So what I'm going to be covering is broadly three steps that will help you get into a really winning mindset. Okay, so let's dive in. These days, so much to choose from. We're surrounded by so many brands, so many messages all the time. What drives our decisions and our choices as clients? And what drives our clients' choices? Now, I find it really, really helps me to try and get into the head of my potential customers. So the first thing to note, which is really often overlooked, and I cannot stress this enough, is people who land on your website, generally speaking, want you to be the one. No one really enjoys trawling search engine results. People say to you, oh, you know, your competitors are only a click away. And I would like to say to these doom and gloom merchants, so what? You know, when somebody's on my website, we're halfway there. We're over the first hurdle. And these people are going to fall into two categories. They're either going to be someone who's looking for what we do, and if they are, fantastic. All we need to do then is communicate that quickly and cleanly to them without giving them any reason to click back to the Google search results. And if this person is in the other category, people who aren't looking for what we offer, no problem. You've got nothing to lose. We're unlikely to be able to turn them around at this point. They're probably looking for something else. But what we might hope to do is leave a positive impression. So that one day when they're sitting there at their desk going, do you know what we really need? Somebody who does expert site reviews or somebody who specialises in Web 2.0 design. You might hope that they'll remember you. Really important to get your head around this reality that people who are visiting your sites are your friends and they want you to be right. So all you have to do is not bugger it all up. Okay, so let's take it for granted that your honoured site visitor is in the first camp. They're here because they're looking for what you offer. They want you to be the agency for them. We're moving on to step two, how to let them make a positive decision. Now, here my advice is work out who they really are. Who are your real customers? I see a lot of small agencies and freelancers and on their websites, they try and portray themselves as something they're not, either bigger or broader or more capable. We don't need to do that. Absolute core of this whole blurb that I'm spouting out. Don't pretend to be a big corp mega bucks agency if you're not. Yeah, the whole trick is to be who you are and portray that in a strong way that people love, that people connect with. I mean, you've seen all this stuff where people say we this and we that, you know, all over their website when it's clearly one guy sitting in his bedroom. Now, there's nothing wrong with being one guy sitting in your bedroom doing work. There's a market for that kind of thing. And the other kind of stuff you find is people who say, oh, we do work for clients ranging from, you know, 50 quid jobs for small local businesses up to mega gazillion jobs for international blah, blah, blah. And you sit there going, you don't do those kinds of jobs. So who are you trying to win? Are you trying to win BMW and Sony and Disney? Do you think that those guys are going to come along to your website and fall for this stuff? Let's say they did. Let's go on a flight of fancy. and say that the marketing VP of marketing for Disney lands on your website because he just happens to find himself between web agencies looking for a new one, and he goes, oh wow, these people seem to have a team, although I can't see them, there's no names and there's not much of a portfolio, and they say that they work with companies just like mine, massive global conglomerate. Let's say you've caught him on a bad day, he accidentally picks up the phone and calls you. How long is he going to be on the phone for? 1 minute? 2 minutes? Before he realises that you can't possibly give him the security that he, as a big, massive client, needs. So we just need to accept these aren't the guys who are going to be paying your wage. So think, who are the real people who want what you offer? And then we brand ourselves, we pitch ourselves for those people uniquely. There's no point pretending to be what you're not. What you need to do is present what you are in the best light possible, which brings us on to step 3. How to show who you are in a way that wins customers. So the trick is to examine all the aspects of what you are, what you do, and how you work, whether you perceive it as positive or negative, and build those things into a brand, into a whole impression that really delivers for you. So let's get back into our customer's head. Who are they, first of all? So they're not BMW and Disney and all these guys. They're not going to be paying your bills. Who's going to be paying your bills? Who needs what you have? This is a two-way match between supply and demand. You can't just be what you're not. You can only offer what you can offer. You can't sell to people who need something else. So let's start with the givens. Let's start with what you are, what your capabilities are, what you can do. And then picture a market for that. The trick here is to select what to show that might make you memorable and create a connection. Often the things that you might perceive as weakness, for example, if you're stuck in that mindset of thinking you need to pretend to be a massive full-service agency, the things that you think are weaknesses may, in fact, be real strengths if you can spin them right, if you can present them in the right way. But fundamentally, this is all about getting your head around it. Branding isn't about pretending to be something you're not. Branding is about working out who you are and what you really do, and then standing there and saying it with confidence in a way that really impacts people. Okay, so let's look at a few things. You might be thinking, oh, we're not based in central London. Great! You're nearer your local customers. You're nearer to those local small businesses who want somebody round the corner. They don't want a big kind of Soho agency. Well, you're sitting there thinking, we're just one person. Oh, fantastic! You've got no huge wage bills. You know, it keeps the costs down. And very often your clients can know that they can pick up the phone. They might even have your mobile number. They can pick up the phone. They can speak to you. And that's worth an awful lot to a lot of clients, knowing who is going to be on the other end of the phone. What about if you haven't got an office? Who cares if you haven't got an office? You go to your clients and meet at their premises. It also keeps the fees down. Your local clients will respect that. You don't know everything about web technology. Who does? You know, you might be a specialist in PHP or CSS, or you might have a particular passion for religious organisations or green issues, or you know, whatever it is, whatever you really floats your boat, that's what you want to do. Let's do that. Nobody knows everything. So if you're a small scale agency, we talk about this a lot, everyone's got a network of other professionals and amateurs in your area or around the world who can help. And even the big agencies do that. Everybody does that. So what we're talking about is say what you're really about. Lots of people make a positive decision to work with my agency, Scratch Media, after reading our ethical policy that we publish on our website. And that works great for us because the kind of clients that we love to work for are actually attracted by reading that stuff. And the other clients who are in industries that we don't bother to get in touch, which saves everybody time and effort. So now you're getting a brand together. We need to build in what your audience wants. So, if you're really suited to dealing with other small local businesses, say, think about what signs, what signals they're looking for to be able to make a positive decision to take the next step. So there's two important things to remember here. Remember, the customer is on your side, they want you to be the one, and also, new one, you don't have to close a sale on your website. The job of the website is to get a qualified visitor from the point of first initial contact, knowing nothing about you, to the point of taking the next step. That's it. So focus your efforts on giving the right kind of visitor the right kind of signals that you're probably right for them. That is all you need to do. Now, generally, you'll be looking to reinforce just a few points. And I always think of these as like checkboxes in somebody's mind. I like to picture somebody, think what they look like, think where they're working, sitting at their computer, typing something into a search engine and clicking on some results. And thinking, all right, what are the checkboxes? What are the 3 or 4 checkboxes, not usually more than that, in this person's mind that I need to tick off? And if you can tick off those checkboxes without upsetting the person or giving them any reason to go away and not believe in you, then you've probably done your job. Then what you do is you say, here's a call to action. If you want to talk about this more, fantastic, pick up the phone and call me, and I'd love to speak to you. So let's imagine, depending on the market that you're talking to, what kind of checkboxes might be in somebody's head. I think very often they're things like, I can trust these guys, or they're not going to be too expensive, they'll fit my budget, or they like working with companies like mine. So they're looking for evidence of all of those things. And it might be like we said before, I can get somebody on the phone if I need help. And clients aren't necessarily super confident in their requirements. You know, if it's an engineering company and they don't know anything about really media or marketing in particular, then there's no reason to think that they're sitting there being really, really cynical. What they're looking for, a friend. They're looking for someone to be on their side and to help them through this process. All we need to do is get them effectively to feel good about you, really, is what we're saying. We have to get them from first finding you to coming to a point where they've got no reason to think that you're not the right agency for them. Then you give them a call to action and you say, let's get together, let's talk about what we can do for you. The thing I'd add here is to do with focus. You need to plan the steps from the homepage through to that call to action. Now, you know, your website might only be one page. You might only need one page to do that. You don't have to have a news section. If you've not got news to give, don't put a news section on because it'll be a dead pit. You should put on your website only the things that you need to get that person from A through to B. And you need to be very, very focused about it. So don't put in more pages than you need. Don't put in more images than you need. Don't put in more blurb, bump, rhubarb. Because the more blurb, bump and rhubarb that you put on your website, the more you're going to be watering down your message. Get all these steps right. You have done your job and you should see the difference in your bottom line.
Okay, so that about wraps it up for this show, other than, of course, Marcus's wonderful joke. Or have you completely dried up?
I've got a very quick one. A reporter was interviewing a 104-year-old woman and he said, and what do you think is the best thing about being 104? And she replied, no peer pressure.
That's quite a poor one. But, they tell jokes as well on the Riddington podcast.
Ah,
so they're ripping us off. But what's quite interesting is their jokes are even worse than yours, but they've got an excuse. Apparently they all come out of this kind of 1950s war joke book.
Oh, right.
So they make no sense whatsoever if you're under like 60. So there you go. But they are still vaguely funny, I guess. So anyway, that about wraps up this week's show. Hopefully next week me and Marcus will have less cold. And so we will be crisper and more something. Articulate, that's the word. Yes. The thing that I'm not at the moment. Don't forget to check out our show notes at boagworld.com/podcast. I think we've kind of sorted the problems with the forum. It seems to be running a little bit better. So you can get to that at boagworld.com/forum. It'd be good to see people get back involved in that again, as I know it kind of tailed off a little bit. Also, don't forget on the show notes, you can make comments as well. I don't know whether I've ever said that before. You can go to the show notes and you can place your comments on what you thought of the show or any comments you've got about what we said, that kind of stuff. So loads of good stuff. Thank you very much for listening. Oh, and by the way, thank you very much for voting for us for the South by Southwest panels. Marcus will find out the result of whether he's going to South by Southwest next year before too long. Thanks very much for listening and goodbye.